I was looking at the news this week, as many of you were, about the hurricane coming into the Houston area and seeing, you know, different houses in Galveston along the beach built up on these different foundations. And what a precarious thing it is when you have a powerful storm surge that has the potential of wiping out those supports that the entire structure is built on, and then you see buildings collapsing. And as I came to the text this morning, I thought, you know, it's a very appropriate illustration for the Jesus that we've been encountering recently, where in Luke chapter 15, which we're beyond that now to chapter 16, but the Jesus of Luke 15 has gone to these religious elites, the power brokers of his society, and he has washed out the foundations of their lives. Basically, everything that they're building their lives upon, he's told them that is the wrong foundation, that is an unsustainable foundation. And we saw this, you know, first of all, in that famous parable of the prodigal son, which we talked about a couple Sundays ago, where essentially Jesus' message to the Pharisees, to the religious, is the story's really as much about the older brother as it is the prodigal. And he's showing them that the self-righteous legalist is every bit as far from the heart of God as any rebel. If you want to pile up a record of your own righteousness, God, I've always stayed home, I've always done these things for you, and you never rewarded me the way I feel like I deserve, he says, then your heart is as lost as any rebel. And then what we looked at last Sunday, he turns right around on the heels of that parable, and he condemns not money, not having lots of nice things, but he condemns an attitude of greed where you go through life and your money and your time is just used selfishly for yourself. And what we see is the Pharisees have built their whole identity on these twin pillars of performance and prosperity. It's kind of an ancient version of the prosperity gospel, because the Pharisees would teach this to other people, that if you are holy and righteous and good like we are, then God will bless you materially. And Jesus has come along and said, your performance isn't good enough. And that's not why you're prosperous. You're prosperous because you as shepherds are fleecing your own sheep. You are making money off your people rather than ministering to your people. Then we come to the text this morning. So that's a little bit of background for what we come to. And you can imagine how this is going to lead off, right? That Jesus, this famous rabbi, thousands and thousands of people are following him rather than you. And he's just undermined what you built your house and your life on. Luke 16, verse 14. The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all these things and they ridiculed him. And he said to them, you are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. The law and the prophets were until John. Since then, the good news of the kingdom of God is preached and everyone forces his way into it. But it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for even one dot of the law to become void. Then he says this, verse 18, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. This is the word of the Lord. Let's make sense of what Jesus is saying. Now, the first thing I want you to notice is that when they see Jesus has washed out our foundation of performance, what we do for God, and he has washed out our pillar of prosperity, that we are wealthier, way wealthier than the typical people that we minister to, the typical person in our culture. And Jesus has wrecked that. He's pulled that down. Their reaction, verse 14, is that they sneer at him, they ridicule him. And it's actually an interesting word, because it literally means that they turn up their nose at him. And you know how, you know, 90% of communication is nonverbal, right? And people hear the words that you say, but they also hear the tone and they see your body language. And sometimes people have to caution one another, like, I hear what you're saying, but your body language just communicated. Well, with their body language, they're communicating, Jesus, you're an idiot. I mean, who do you think you are to challenge us, the holy, the righteous ones? And I want you to notice that as we go on through these verses I just read, Jesus isn't done with saying your performance isn't good enough, your prosperity, nobody cares about that. Because he goes on in verse 15 to say that even though you appear to be holy and righteous and good, God knows the true condition of your heart. And you may have fooled everyone on the outside, but God sees your heart and God knows you're very far from him. And what I want to talk about this morning is, how is that possible? And I mean, how is it possible that some of the people still today in our culture who appear to be the religious ones, the ones who go to church, who serve people, who are doing well spiritually, they may have it all wrong? And this few collection of verses, which we'll make sense of in just a moment, Jesus is going to tell you, here's how that happens. Let me talk to you about the law. Let me talk to you about the heart. Let me talk to you about the gospel. And this is going to be really simple. And here's what I hear Jesus saying. Jesus, this whole collection of verses, as odd as it is to put this together, he's saying the law will wreck you. The law of God will wreck you until you understand and treasure the gospel. Okay, so point one, the law of God sets the standard. This is what Jesus is saying. Okay, as cryptic as this may sound to us, the Pharisees understand Jesus is saying, okay, you want to talk about the law? You want to say that I'm a lawbreaker, that I'm here to overthrow the law? I'm telling you, the law of God sets the standard for all human behavior. And we return to this notion in context that today people look at Jesus and the gospel. Christians today are like, yeah, the Old Testament, we don't have to worry about that, right? We don't have to read the Old Testament. We don't have to do those laws because Jesus, right? Jesus. And this is the way the Pharisees are thinking. Look at verse 16. You could even conclude that from what Jesus himself says. The first part of verse 16, he says, the law and prophets were until John. So he's saying the Old Testament, he's summarizing, the Old Testament was until John. Since then, the good news of the kingdom is preached. And you can say, boom, there it is. See, it's all about grace and kindness and friendship and freedom. We can kind of do what we want now and what feels right to us as followers of Jesus. You know, does it seem Christ-like? Does it seem kind? But look right to the next verse, verse 17. Jesus goes on to say, but it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one dot of the law to become void. Do you know what a dot of the law is? It's kind of like today how we have serif and sans serif fonts. Okay? You all familiar with the difference of those two? The serifs are those little tiny things that do like this and like this and turn it into a serif font. And the word that Jesus uses here is basically like the serifs of the law are not going to pass away until all of it is fulfilled. And Jesus is giving here a general principle of the law's perpetual authority and permanence, saying the law of God set the standard for the Old Testament people of God. The law of God still sets the standard today, and not a serif of it is going to be done away with. It's not going to fail. It's not going to become void until all of it is fulfilled. And this is how we make sense of verse 18, which sounds really out of context, where he's talking about divorce and marriage and remarriage. And you're like, what does that have to do with what you're talking about? Well, all he's doing is giving a specific example. So the general principle is the law of God has this abiding relevance and permanence and authority over our lives. For example, think about sexuality and gender and marriage and divorce and remarriage. And he says, and a principle that you found way back in Genesis 1 and 2 is still valid. And I think Jesus simply chose that particular example because the Pharisees loved to debate this. And this was an area where Jesus would have kind of taken a white hot iron and penetrated their hearts. Because they know that they're playing games with the Old Testament and they're finding all kinds of justification. Well, I don't like this woman anymore. She this. And they go to Deuteronomy 24 and they say, well, even Moses said it was okay. So we're going to do that. And I think this is incredible relevance to today, that when Jesus is asked about the law in general, he illustrates it by talking about sexuality and gender, and he goes all the way back to Genesis 1 and 2 and says, this is how the Father designed it. Okay? So my application to us is, if the law of God sets the standard for human behavior, then we would do well to know the law of God. Okay? And I know that in our Bible reading plans, sometimes it gets very tedious to wade into parts of Exodus and Leviticus. And we're like, you know, what's the lobster thing and all that? And we should talk about that sometime, not this morning, okay? But I think today as Christians, even we can think of law as a dirty word. And we don't have the attitude of David, who in Psalm 1, you know, the verses that lead off the 150 Psalms? David says something like this: blessed is the one who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of God. And in his law he meditates day and night. And that's not often a thing that we feel when we approach God's law. Man, I delight to know God's law. You know, Psalm 119, 97. Oh, how I love your law. Do not let me wander from your commandments. And we're like, love? I mean, that love's kind of a strong word. Appreciate, maybe. He's like, I love your law. Why would we delight in the law? Why would we love the law? Because it reveals to us who our God is and how we can please our God. And this is all well and good. Point one, that the law of God sets the standard. That's all well and good. But here's the problem. We don't measure up. That's the whole deal. I mean, in the Garden of Eden, God's like, okay, do anything you want. I've got one command for you. One rule. One law. And what do Adam and Eve do? They don't do the one thing. I mean, the problem is anytime God gives us something to do, there's something about us, there's something about me, where we do not measure up to that standard. And that creates another problem. And this is what Jesus is saying. If the law of God sets the standard, the human heart adjusts the standard. When we see that, okay, the standard of God is here, and I know intuitively that I am here. Do you know what the natural instinct of every single one of us is? And I don't care. Like, if you've got little kids, about what I'm about to say, you're going to be like, stay-at-home mom. You see this about 2,000 times a day. Okay? Because we do this two ways. Number one, we lower the standard of God to something achievable. Number two, and I'm going to describe both of these in a minute. Number two, we elevate, we raise our performance to something adequate. Okay, so we're taking hold of the law of God, we're pulling it down, we're taking our miserable, abysmal performance sometimes, and we're pulling it up, and so we can do like that. There, see, I'm a good person, I'm okay. I please God. It's like, man, who are we kidding ourselves? And this is illustrated in Jesus' own example of divorce and remarriage. People in the Old Testament were very much like people today, that they hear the law of God and they're like, okay, a man and a woman for their entire lives. I mean, there got to be like a lot of loopholes, right? Because what if you fall out of love? Like, you think you're the first person that ever thought of that? What if 10 years into my marriage, I realize, oh no, she's not my soulmate. And these people in the Old Testament, including the forerunners of the Pharisees, started playing all kinds of games, because in Deuteronomy 24, Moses wrote a law and he says, okay, you know what? I see you're all getting divorces. You're marrying her. And she doesn't please you. You divorce her. Then you marry somebody else. She doesn't please you. Then you marry someone else. She doesn't please you. Then you're like, man, I was better off with the first girl. And you go back to her. And to kind of shut that thing down, Moses says in Deuteronomy 24, you can't do that. If you leave her, if you divorce her and you move on, you can't go back. And that was to protect the woman. To protect the powerless in their society. And what the Pharisees were doing, because Moses used this interesting word, like, if you find something detestable in her, you know, and they're like, oh, man, it's detestable the way she cooks, I'll tell you that right now. And they were literally doing this. Like, I can't even look at her. Her face is just detestable to me. And by the time of Jesus, they had grown their body of law to, like, the Pharisees themselves as religious, holy men of God. They had no commitment to their marriages. And they found all kinds of reasons to say, my wife is detestable. She's loathsome to me. You can't seriously think that God wants me to stay in a bad marriage and be unhappy. And what are the Pharisees themselves doing? They're doing A, right? They're lowering the standard of God to something achievable. They're saying, we don't want to stay committed to the same woman our whole lives. And some of the wives are doing this. I don't want to stay committed to him. Him? Really? Like, you should know him the way I know him. And they added more and more loopholes to pull the law of God down. And Jesus is saying to this whole thing, he's like, you got to be kidding me. Look at verse 15 again. He says, you justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. And what Jesus is talking about in context then is, like, they can go to their synagogues and they can high five each other for, like, bro, I thought of another way you can leave your wife. Really? What is it? My wife's a pest. What is it? And they share and they're like, bam, that's solid, man. And Jesus is like, are you kidding me? So what you're exalting, what you're celebrating in your culture, I see your heart. You don't have a heart of love. You don't have a heart of sacrifice, a heart of generosity, a heart of commitment. Like, no fruit of the Spirit, nothing. And God isn't amused when we do this self-justification thing. And I want to park here for just a moment, and I wanted to give you some general principles, and I've given you space if you want to write some of these down that are helpful to you. Here are some ways that we lower the standard, okay? Well, and I've already given you one. One way we lower the standard is we say, that's just the Old Testament. And I'm a New Covenant Christian. Okay, so you've taken half to two-thirds of the Bible and said, it just doesn't apply to me. Now, again, we could have nuanced conversation about what applies to us and what doesn't. Because I believe that the civil, the ceremonial law that governed Israel does not apply to us. Because Jesus himself, you know, God in the book of Acts, he's telling Peter, you know, that there aren't unclean animals anymore. Like, rise, kill and eat. And Peter's like, no, God, my conscience, I can't do that. And he's like, do not call unclean when I call clean. So there's a more nuanced conversation than what I'm saying. But to just take two-thirds of the Bible and say, but it doesn't apply to me. Well, we're lowering the standard. Something I see all the time is we say, that can't, we read something in the Bible, we say, that can't possibly mean that. It must mean something else. And imagine if someone was doing that to your words all the time, that you just write an email, and what you're saying is really clear in context, and just consistently people are saying, well, he couldn't have possibly meant that. He probably meant this other thing, and you're like, why can't you just take the plain sense of my words? And I see our culture, including our Christian culture, doing this today in areas like sexuality, where we look at the Bible and it's really clear and we're like, well, that can't possibly mean that. And we lower the standard. We change the standard. We adjust the standard to something more achievable. Like, maybe guys in particular, I think we do this with areas like pride and lust, where Jesus talks about these things. We're like, to look at a woman with lustful intent, that's like, that can't mean that. Another way we do that is we say, I think God means we just don't do it all the time. Like, lying, okay. He can't mean like you go through life without lying. He just means like don't make a total habit, don't be a complete liar. And we play these games. One I hear in counseling often, I'm not singling anybody out, but sometimes we're like, that makes me unhappy. And I'm sure God just wants me to be happy. And so we adjust the standard to something achievable because we want what we want. Let's flip this around. What are some ways that we elevate our performance? Well, first of all, we say, of course, X is wrong, but I'm not doing X. I'd agree. It's wrong to gossip. But when I talk to my friends about someone else's sin, And what are we doing? We're elevating our performance so that we can hit a benchmark that God has set for us. We do this with lying. Like, I know lying's wrong, but I'm stretching the truth. I'm making my point more accurate by exaggerating. Another one is greed and envy. Greed is one of those things you can always see it in somebody else, But who sits there and is like, yep, I am greedy. I'm totally envious of other people and their stuff. And I just want more and more material things. And this is a way we elevate our performance by saying, of course, greed is wrong, but I'm not greedy. I just want, you know, I want the American dream. I want a standard baseline of nice things like everyone else around me, but I'm not greedy. Here's another way we elevate our performance. We think if I don't get caught, it's basically like I'm not doing it. I mean, tell me I'm wrong. Like guys on the internet, if I don't get caught, it's like I'm not hurting my marriage. I'm not darkening my own soul. Adultery, it's fine. Like, I know it's bad, but it's basically like I'm not doing it if I don't get caught. And we're elevating our performance to something achievable. We know what the law of God says. And we're like, but I haven't gotten caught. Another way we elevate our performance, we think it's not as bad as what so-and-so is doing. Or so-and-so did it to me first. You know, again, if you're a stay-at-home mom, you hear this every single day. And we're correcting our children. And it's like, did you just take a fistful of sand from the sandbox and throw it in your brother's eyeballs? Yes, but he threw sand in my eyeballs first. And it's like, and did that hurt? Yes, it was excruciating. Okay, so then why did you? Because he did it first. And what are we doing? It's like, instead of just saying, yes, I was wrong. It was sinful. I'm mistreating my brother. It's like, but he did it first. It's a way we try to make our behavior sound better than what it actually is. Another way we elevate our performance is, I mean, we just lie. And what I mean is we flat out deny doing the very thing we're doing. And it's like, see, it's I'm fine. I'm okay. This is self-justification. This is what we're talking about. To say, I know I'm doing this, but I'm just going to say I'm not doing it, and therefore I'm not doing it. I mean, people get caught in lying and stealing and cheating and, I mean, all kinds of things and just say, like, well, I'm not doing it. Or how about this one? I did it halfway for the wrong reason. That's good enough, right? It's like, go clean your room entirely. You know, and they put like two things away out of 12,000 and they're like, I'm done. You can inspect my room. And you go around and around. It's like, you're not done. That's not going to fly with God when we do that same sort of thing. I did it halfway for the wrong reason. That counts, right? No, it doesn't. We do the whole, I'm doing this good thing over here to offset the bad. So if you take this, you know, I've got a -4 and I know it, but I got a +6 over here and that's +2. I achieved the standard of God. You know, it's like the guy who always talks about energy and killing the planet and all this. And he flies around the world in his personal private 747. And it's like, wait, what? He's like, well, I buy energy credits to offset. And we do that spiritually. I know I don't achieve the law of God here. I don't obey it here. But I do this other thing over here. And on the whole, and then, you know, maybe my favorite, one of the ways we try to elevate our performance is that we don't even try. We just say, who are you to judge me? And what is that saying? It's saying, get out of my life, get out of my business. You have no right to say that what I'm doing is not up to the standard. And that's just meant to be practical to you so you can see, like I do that too. And my question is, why do we do this? Why do we do this? Why is Jesus going after the heart of these religious people? And again, verse 15 saying, you justify yourself so hard before men, but God knows your hearts. Why do we do it? And the answer is because we're more concerned with what other people think than what God actually knows to be true. I mean, and I'm not asking for a show of hands, but how many of you in your private walk with Christ, you obsess over God? You know the person that I am. And like Jesus let off the Beatitudes, blessed are the meek, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are the broken. But most of us don't tend to camp out there and obsess about God. You know the real me, transform the real me. We're just like, okay, does my wife know about this yet? Okay, I'm still good there. Okay, what about my boss? What about these people, like at church and these other communities? And we're just constantly manipulating the record of our own performance because we're more concerned with what others think about us, our reputation, than what God knows to be true. Our oldest son, who's 4, and most of you know him, Micah, he loves to play sports right now, and he loves to self-justify in sports. So we set up these little hockey goals in the basement, and he'll often shoot the puck, and I either save it or I don't even have to because he misses the goal. And then he literally just goes over, and the puck is right here next to the goal, and he'll be like, "Hey, Dad, can you get me the thing out of the refrigerator?" And he picks up the goal and moves it so the puck is in the corner of the goal. And then I come back and he's like, "You said I missed. And it's right. You can clearly see, Dad, that I..." And it's like, Micah, you're more concerned with what others think of you than what God knows to be true. And from God's perspective, or even, you know, sometimes if I use this term, the omnipotent perspective, the sovereign perspective. Oftentimes as parents, you have an omnipotent perspective. You saw what happened, right? That's what I mean by that. Not that you're God, but you saw what happened. And you're never impressed when someone else self-justifies, are you? You're not like, "Wow, that was really clever. Okay, I guess you get a point." You're like, "Kid." And I'm doing this week with my kid, and, you know, and God's like, "Yeah, you kind of do the same thing yourself, don't you?" Again, like, God has set the standard. You miss the mark and you move the target when you think nobody's looking. See, I hit the target. And all I want to say here as my final point is there's a way better way forward, especially as a community of faith, than lowering God's standard or lying about our own performance to adjust the record. There's a way better way forward than self-justification. Okay? So it's true, okay? And I don't want you to miss this. It is true that we have missed the mark with our lives. It's true that if the bar is here, we've gone up and we've not cleared that bar. And we realize, like, okay, I didn't obey God. I deserve His punishment. That's what I deserve. I didn't keep the law. I deserve the punishment of the law. But here's the good news. Point three is that if the law of God sets the standard and the human heart adjusts the standard, what we need to hear Jesus saying is that the gospel of Jesus fulfills the standard. And I'm choosing that word carefully. Fulfills the standard. And we need to understand that God does not lower the bar for anyone and say, "Okay, I see, child, you're having a hard time clearing this hurdle, so we're going to start lower." He just leaves it where it's at. But then rather than condemning you, judging you, punishing you because you didn't jump over the hurdle, you know what he does? He jumps over the hurdle for you. He gets the trophy and he hands you the trophy. He says, "Boom, there you go. That's the gospel." Okay? So let me summarize some of these verses. So he talks about, again, the law and the prophets. So let's look at this verse again. Verse 16. Now we're going to put this all back together. The law and the prophets were until John. Okay, let me summarize the whole law with one little statement. The whole law of God says, you are God's people, so here's how to worship and obey Him. It's the whole law. And I know it gets it down in the weeds with the crustaceans. But the whole law of God says, you are God's people. You are God's redeemed people. Now, here's how you worship and obey and please Him. And then to summarize all the prophets, the rest of the Old Testament, they say, you're still God's people, but you have not worshipped and obeyed Him, so now you're in big trouble. And they said it 1,000 different ways, but that's the message of the prophets. You're still God's people. You did not obey the law. You did not worship God. You're in big trouble. And Jesus now, so going on in verse 16, Jesus now says the law and prophets were preached until John. Okay, who's that? John the Baptist. And he's saying the last of those prophets, John. If you start reading in the first chapters of the Gospels, John's saying stuff that sounds a lot like the prophets. You're still God's people, but you haven't worshipped and obeyed Him, so now you're in big trouble. Right? That's what John says. Until this one moment in John 1:29, where John changed his message. Because he's saying, you've fallen short of what God requires. Repent. And then there's this moment. He's down there baptizing people who are repenting of their sins and turning back to the heart of God. And all of a sudden, Jesus, his head pops up over the hill and he's coming. And when John looks up and sees Jesus, y'all know what he said? He didn't say, oh, there's the next prophet. He's got the next word from God. You should listen to him in conjunction with listening to me. I don't want to lose my thing. No, he says, look. Directs everyone's attention. Behold, it's one of those big Greek words. Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. He's no longer saying, here's another prophet summarizing, you're still God's people, you worship and obey. You didn't worship and obey, now you're in big trouble. He says, look, there's the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And I want us to understand that because of Jesus, we don't have to be Pharisees adjusting the record, lowering the standard, pretending that we're something that we're not, because we can all say, look, there's Jesus. He took away our sin. I'll give you two analogies. Anybody know the name Fred Lortz? Or Fred Lors? I don't know how to say it. I looked up pronunciation guides and I couldn't find it. Fred Lors, okay? 1904, Fred decided to enter the Boston Marathon. Much to his surprise, he came in fourth. So he's like, cool. I came in fourth in the Boston Marathon. I'm going to run for the United States in the Olympics the same year. Well, the Olympics that year, bad planning. I don't know what they were thinking back then. But the Olympics, the Summer Olympics, were in St. Louis. Have you ever been in St. Louis in the summer? It's miserable. It's really hot. It's like 12,000% humidity. And he enters the Olympic Marathon in St. Louis. Which, by the way, that year, most of the male field did not even come close to finishing the marathon. They all dropped out. But Fred, 9 miles into the marathon, he's like, I can't do it. His body quit on him. So his manager comes along, picks him up in his car. And so it's like, well, we'll just drive to the finish line and celebrate the festivities. Well, yeah, he drinks something, gets a little bite to eat. And 11 miles into this drive, Fred got his second wind. And he got out of the car and he got back on the course. And he was the first to run across the finish line and break the tape. Okay? So they have him up on the stand, like, Fred Lors. And the next guy was like 16 minutes behind him. Okay? They're like, Fred Lors, gold medal winner, 1904 Olympics. And Fred, like, to his credit, says, I did this as a joke. Like, I mean, people were cheering. I got back out and I started running kind of as a joke. And then people started cheering for me. And it just kind of got, I got into the moment, and before I knew it, I'm breaking the tape of the Olympic marathon. And so on the stand, he's like, it wasn't me, the second place guy's gold, and I'm out. So he got disbarred from the sport. But I want you to picture Fred, okay? Fred, he lowered the standard of the Olympic marathon. And we'd all agree with that. And what Jesus would say to Fred is, I ran the marathon for you, and you do get the gold. I'll give you another illustration. Some of you have different kinds of debt. You have credit card debt. You have, you know, your home mortgage. You have school debt. Now imagine that you owe someone else money and you go through life and you say, okay, I know I owe my college $60,000. But every time you talk to your college, you're like, no, I don't owe you $60,000. I owe you $40,000. First of all, that's the amount that I paid for that stuff way back there. It's only $40,000. It's not $60,000. And they're like, no, it's 60, and you've repaid 2,500 of that. And you're like, no, 2,500, I've repaid 25,000. And this is the picture, like it's a financial picture, but it's a picture of what we're doing with God. Is we're saying, the standard's not that high. We pull that down, and I've repaid more. So now it's just this kind of gap, and we're trying to close the gap. And Jesus is like, just let the gap be huge. You know why? Because what fills the gap? The cross and the grace of Jesus Christ. And this is how Paul can come to the New Testament and say, why don't you just boast in your weakness? Why don't you just boast in your failure? Because when you do that, you're making much of Jesus. And I got a problem with us as Christians, myself included, is that when our natural tendency of self-justification is to shrink the gap that Christ has bridged with his blood, we're going the wrong way. I mean, the message we should be telling the world is like, yeah, it's as bad as you think it is. It's worse. I mean, Keller always says, you are far worse than you ever allowed yourself to imagine. But simultaneously, you are more loved and accepted in Jesus than you could ever hope or dream. And the gospel is holding those two things together. Okay, so my closing application, be humble, be honest, be authentic, be vulnerable. Okay, me first. when I'm praying and praying and praying for God to do something, like in my personal life, in our church, in our community, in our city, there are times where not only is God not giving that thing that I think is biblical to pray for, it feels like God is either allowing or doing the exact opposite of that. And there's unfairness, there's injustice, we feel like we're going backwards sometimes. And I'm just telling you, like, in those times, I'm like, God, why am I praying? It seems like you're not listening. And I'll tell you, what happens in my heart is that my heart gets more anxious and frustrated, and I question God. And some of you do too. If my hope is built on having a reputation for, like, man, that dude's bomb-proof. Like, whatever happens in his life, everything can be blowing up. And, like, he just, like, he cannot be shaken. I'll just tell you, like, if my hope is that you think that of me, this is not true. But if my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness, and that's that song, right? The hymn. My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and His righteousness, then I can stand up here and say, you know what, I need your prayers. I need your support. Because this is where I struggle probably more than anywhere else in my life. And the scripture that Jesus is teaching these Pharisees is basically an invitation for them to come clean. Just take off the mask, guys. You know, since the Garden of Eden, like, what do Adam and Eve do? The inclination, the moment they sin, is to, I mean, number one, they blame each other. But then the inclination is, like, I've got to hide this. I've got to cover my own shame. And they find, like, stinking fig leaves, and they're hiding behind their fig leaves. And Jesus is like to these Pharisees, guys, if you understood that I fulfilled the standard for you and I offer it to you as a free gift, lose the fig leaves. Because your hope of conquering your shame and your guilt that you walk through life with is not getting better at hiding it, getting better at somehow justifying the things that you think and the emotions that you feel and the ways that you react, but saying, this is who I was, but because of Christ, this is who I no longer will be. Now, here's why I entitled the message, Bad News for Good People. The gospel is bad news for good people. If you're not willing to accept the gospel, the law is really bad news for good people, because it says you're not as good as you think you are. And you're not going to fool this judge. But the very thing that is bad news for good people is good news for bad people who just say, I'm one of those bad people. And I need to be washed, because there's a big gap between my performance and what God requires, and I'm not going to close that gap with adjusting the record and playing this Pharisaical self-justification game. I'm going to look to Jesus, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, and He will do that for you this morning. And He will do that for you over and over again when you fail like I fail. I'm going to close with these words of the old hymn, Rock of Ages. He says, not the labor of my hands can fulfill the law's demands. Could my zeal no respite know, could my tears forever flow, all for sin could not atone. Thou must save, and thou alone. That's the message of this text. We look to Jesus again this morning, rather than adjusting the record with your zeal, your tears, your promises, and just say, Jesus, you do it.